This is really a case study about a product, but generally it's about the whole NHS. It's really about measuring things. So whilst there is innovation behind this presentation, it's really about how we measured its impact on the NHS and how we're still measuring it, really. So I was delighted to hear a lot of the data-driven presentations today, because we're still looking. So behind this company is a medtech innovator, really, is a company incubator that is there to actually build companies that go behind disease states and identify clinical needs and launch a company to actually bring those to healthcare systems. So the interesting thing is they don't actually launch anything until they've proven the actual efficiency of it and actually generate some data. And in fact, they fold companies before they come into the commercial domain. The fundamental point of this Exploramed background company really is that it has to generate patient care that is improved. And this is a kind of a backstory of where they've actually innovated before. They have a history of innovation, of bringing companies forward. So it kind of gives a bit of credence to why NeoTrack, which is a company I represent, has come forward. We'll move on really to the area of our expertise, the glamorous area of the prostate. It's the non-cancerous disease that actually doesn't get a lot of mention, but in fact it's just about this area here, the area of the prostate, this magical little walnut-shaped organism that causes a bunch of problems, low urinary tract symptoms. So when we look at this particular disease, they actually call it the elbow referral, because the symptoms might not mean, you know, a great deal to some people here, but in fact it affects a lot of people. In fact, 50% of people, men over 50, will be impacted by this disease at some stage. And it will have an impact on quality of life for a lot of people. And that's why they call it the elbow referral. So you look at these symptoms, you think, well, so what? And that's what we heard in the beginning of our journey, so what? It's a huge disease state. And when you look at the actual overall measurement here, 13.7 million men in Europe are treated for it every year. You start to realize the impact of it. You know, it gets a lot of... It blocks up the system is the essence of it. And 73% of these people are managed on drugs. 25% of these people, 26% of these people drop out of drugs and sit there waiting for their bladder to decay because there's no surgical option that they want to risk. And then we actually see in the acute sector there 3% of this problem. And as trends move on, you start to realize that it's actually a time bomb waiting to happen as people live longer. And I know you've heard that situation, well, that story quite a bit. So I want to talk to you a little about how we measure that, really, and what really is the issue here. So we talked about the prostate, and a lot of this disease curing or you know, preventative state really is about the prostate. It's actually about the bladder, and that's a far more serious issue. As this time goes on, the bladder decays, and you start to see trabeculations in the bladder, and the prostate causes a backing up of the system. And that's when you start to understand, really, that this is a problem waiting to happen, and it's very serious. And these men actually go into surgery much later than they should do. Typical man doesn't outline the problem, ends up spending some years behind actually not being referred, in the end has to have a serious intervention to solve it. So men don't want to come forward, have this solved, because the outcomes, until now, are very severe. They affect every area of their life. So what we're trying to look at here is when you invent one of these new products, really, is to try and implement some kind of preventative or lessen a disease progression. The interesting part here is the surgery sits at the far end of this spectrum, where in fact it doesn't have as much of an impact on the disease progression as it would earlier. So the goal is to get down this treatment algorithm and get something in earlier, so we can actually prevent kind of a one-way street, really. So really that's where we're looking at here. Recently we set out to, having been through some milestones, we were trapped in a funding loop. We went back to NICE and were kind of shoved in the direction of Carter to prove our story. So we've had to do some very detailed analysis, and we're very fortunate and surprised to dig out some very great information from the NHS really. When you start to break this down in primary care and look at the actual money spent on drugs to manage this condition, and imagine these patients go around this cycle for 3 to 10 years, you start to see this might be an issue. So, and this is data from 2004, that the primary care consultations were 1.6 million. I'm certain that's higher now. The amount of spend on drugs really is only the BPH drugs. It's nothing to do with the bladder, the way we manage the bladder pharmaceutically. And then the primary care consultations there at 44 million, very old data really. But that's what's out there. So you start to see 3 to 10 years of this kind of spend, it starts to get a bit more serious. So we're starting to get, you know, some interesting feedback from the NHS, from NICE, really, and start to get a bit of an engagement, really. So when you look at the annual burden of BPH, just in 1 year, you start to see huge numbers appear, really, the cost of care, and you start to see a trend upwards. You start to see this problem isn't going away, it's getting worse. And interestingly enough, if you know you track that over 5 years, you get into the billions. And in fact, when there's an issue with BPH as a wider disease state, 50% of these patients come back into retention, if you like, into emergency care. So you've got a problem at the A&E end. So what considers to be not a particularly interesting disease state happens to be one that is tripping up the system. So we dug deeper into this data and we looked at the surgery side, because that's kind of where we sit. We want to have our device, if you like, positioned further up the chain, if you like. And you start to see that surgeries are going down. That's not a surprise, because drug prescriptions are on the way up. So all we're doing is moving this care later into the paradigm, really. And in fact, people stay in hospitals, you know, an average of 3 days in the country. There's nothing changed this state, really, in this particular area in the last 5-6 years. When you look back over this data set, you start to realize nothing's changed that. And there are literally, you know, multitudes of technology in this space that have had a shot at this. So with our product, we are professing a more minimally invasive approach to this. So we looked at the kind of complications that we felt that we could address with this product, what our data said we could address. And you start to see now that a lot of the complications, no surprises, are first year. And these other complications, really, they don't go away. They continue at a baseline level for another 4 to 5 years. So essentially, the patient doesn't get fixed. It's extremely expensive, and it actually creates some other complications that you then have to manage going forward. So we dug deeper into that and looked at, you know, what kind of costings they would have, because these are directly translatable. If you can actually map a patient journey via ICD-10 codes linked with OPCS codes, so there's great methodology here that fits other technologies that can be used. That's why it's interesting and was interesting to government, in fact. So we measured the cost of complications of the current gold standard surgery, which mapped at 109 million per year, and that's cumulative. So every time you do one set of TURPs per year, you get this cumulative data effect. So then we looked at, okay, how can we impact things immediately in the short term, in the first year? What would that be if we could get some form of adoption? And then we also looked at what the data said about patients who'd gone for the surgery. Where did they go after? And we started to look at what, you know, we could prevent in that area. In fact, they go back on drugs, a percentage of them. And we can measure that because we now had the costs. And then we looked at those patients who actually weren't on drugs, went for surgery, and actually went on drugs as well. So it starts to see this kind of cyclic burden of care that, you know, spanned in this case, you know, over 10 to 15 years. So you start to get a really good picture of build-up from primary care through into surgery and then the complication cycle back. This is as far as we've got, and there's some already scary numbers, really. So our product, UroLift, otherwise known as prostatic urethral lift, really sits in this kind of early stage. You're trying to intervene before the bladder is completely shot, and it actually can't release these symptoms. A lot of the surgery we now do is a last stop affair. So this device really was designed into this space. And the way in which we did that, really, there's only three methodologies to attack the prostate and resolve these issues. Each has a good side and a downside, really. So if you take the tissue out, no matter what technology you use, you have a variation of the same issues. You will disobstruct the prostate, but you're going to have serious side effects. If you look at most minimally invasive technologies which injure, scar, or ablate the prostate, you tend to end up with a modest disobstruction, but there's a human variability in there. So you're now seeing a picture of all these technologies repeating the same cycle. If you cut it out, you have the same kind of outcomes. And the only other version was to open it with a stent, if you like. So you get an immediate result, it irritates, and it actually doesn't do the job. You have to take it out again. So that's fact. So when we designed this product, really, we looked at this kind of area. This is what it must do. It must be really effective. It must be really tolerable. And that's really the basis for designing the product. And we knew that when we looked at the surgical side, they told us this is what it must do if it's going to be any different to this bunch of stuff that happened before that's documented to have failed. So it must change. It must be straightforward. It must be reliable and reproducible. Can everyone do this? A lot of these technologies are highly skill dependent. Must be reproducible. Must be delivered in the ambulatory sector, under local anaesthesia. Real challenge because of patient pain. And it must reduce the complications and give rapid relief. And it, most importantly, in this this part of it, the bladder function must be maintained and it must not destroy sexual function. So it must have years of relief. Because this area of medicine is so oversaturated and so many things have failed, the benchmark of entry is so high that you really have to do your data before you get into it. So you end up being in a space where you really have to prove this beyond doubt before you even enter the market. And that's kind of where we are now. And last but certainly not least at the moment is it must be less expensive. So the view behind this, the simplicity of it was, this is, you know, a mechanical problem. The prostate won't get out the way for you to urinate. So how do we open this tissue? It's benign. We don't need to take it out. It isn't cancerous. Why don't we just move it out of the way? And that's a simple premise for designing this product. That led us to where we are today. It's an implant, a microscopic implant there delivered transprostatically, simply in 15 to 30 minutes, this patient has removed that obstruction, can be done under local anesthesia, has a bunch of benefits, and the patient gets well very soon. That's just me saying it. From an award point of view, this product, the way it was designed, has won awards for a principle of the way in which it works, because it was so clever and simple, but, you know, complex, I guess. And then you look at this 11-year journey, you start to see a level of evidence that's not generally in this space in BPH, starting way back in trials in Australia, you know, and coming into later terms, two lots of nice guidance, really. A fast-track de novo approval in the US, which is about limitation of risk. And now we're into the kind of back end of this. To see something at four-year data in the market in the BPH space before you started, it's a level of credibility you just don't see. So all of these are, you know, well-renowned journals, good quality data. That was just how hard we had to work to get into the surgical space, really, and be, you know, considered. And then we start to go a bit further now. This is the four-year data just released. Some of the products out there don't do this already. They don't have this data, and they're being used in everyday use. So when we look at the safety profile, it's massively minimally invasive. It's proven. They don't have any issues with sexual dysfunction, and these patients generally resolve all their issues in 2 to 4 weeks. When you look at the comparator with current surgery, it can take up to between 6 months and 12 to get back to a level of life, but it will not be the same. It's not normal. So our patients return to normal as a benchline for their ages, and they return there much quicker and they're happier with the surgery. So that's the data side. That led us to where we were with NICE. NICE were impressed with the product. We started to look at an economic value. We looked at this. We submitted some initial data. And this kind of got us to the point where, had we proven the story that we set out to prove, really, and you know, that benchmark really leads us into the capital market. When you measure products in the NHS, you look at the clinical side of things, but you don't actually look at the capital side behind that. So when you start to look at really what this costs the NHS for other technologies, you have to take all of that in consideration. So we took this back to NICE, and it kind of left us in this position where we were still underfunded. We weren't funded correctly, and we had to bring out some more proof, really. And that became an economic discussion. So then we've been in this journey, really, in this kind of loop, and we, you know, kind of deliver some credibility, if you like, and start to engage with the HSNs. That's when things started to really move forward. We've been back to NICE with this data, and NICE was surprised. The Office of Life Science got involved. The Accelerated Access Review got involved. And we started to see a bit of proactive wind, really, here, because we were open. As a company, as a commercial entity, you don't normally find that companies are open to sharing their data. We did that. And we benefited in fact that we could, you know, actually produce some really good economic data that was about the system, not about us. And recently measured, lucky to get a mention in the Accelerated Access Review with an innovative technology that's got cost-saving potential. And then the final win really here was to be awarded an innovation technology tariff. So I think in some ways we were lucky, but we did jump over a few bars to be able to be given that kind of window to prove it, really. So I think it kind of shows a pathway of success by using data to measure the true impact of innovation. So we take that forward, and we look at 40% adoption. That's really conservative. We took our surgeons' opinions, our users, and we look at that across the world. It could be much higher, just at this adoption rate. And we start to now look at the current pathway of spend on the left there, and we add these numbers up. It starts to become a lot more serious. And what I think we'll get to at that point there is we're at the moment we've conservatively estimated to the Carter team a 22 million reduction per year in complications alone. Then you see the efficiency piece that MTEP recognised there, 4 million a year saving, 21,000 bed days, and a bunch of main theatre hours as this product heads into the ambulatory areas from main surgery. And we haven't even measured the actual impact on primary care properly yet. And it's great to hear everyone talking about primary care data here, because I think if you really looked where this patient went after acute care, back around the loop again, you start to see even bigger numbers. And that's what's interesting. That's the journey we're starting to look at now, is to really look at how these patients come around the system. If you speak to GPs, they say the same thing. I have 2 to 3 of these patients a week. They come back, they change drugs, they go on a new regime. But just being able to measure this pathway and seeing what it truly costs and then measure our impact on it, I think puts us in quite a unique place. I think that's why, you know, we were kind of singled out for a case study, really. But that data is there, and that's the important message, really, is that you can take a product and be open and look at how it impacts things. And that's the kind of crazy numbers we're getting to. So from my point of view, it's just the start of the journey. And from April 1, we are funded appropriately. So even in that short time, we managed to get 30 trusts on board who immediately have taken this and see this as a way of delivering some savings and patient care back much quicker. And that's where we stand today. Thank you.